Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. One of the most important theaters in that war, though it's not getting the attention it deserves from many of us, is Asia. And I'm always pleased to have with us a man who is our duty expert on the region and that of Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com, also a frequent contributor to Fox News, among other outlets, namely Gordon Chang. Gordon, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
I want to visit with you first and foremost, Gordon, about the increasingly alarming activities of Chinese pilots operating in a way that is endangering American Navy patrol aircraft in the Western Pacific in international airspace, but nonetheless acting in a manner that is very reminiscent of an earlier episode that brought one of those patrol aircraft down and compromised its highly classified information to the Chinese. What's particularly troubling about this, Gordon, is that the Pentagon, the Obama administration, seem to be putting out the word that these must be rogue pilots operating out of a base in Hainan Island. This couldn't possibly be something that is authorized, and as one put it, something's out of whack. What do you think is going on here?
Well, these incidents have been going on for more than two decades, so it's extremely unlikely that they are the actions of a rogue pilot or a rogue squadron. They've got to be directed from the top, not only of the Chinese People's Liberation Army, but also from the top of the Chinese political system. Think about the alternative. If, in fact, these were rogues, I mean, it would actually be worse, because then we'd be saying for 20 years, the Chinese political leaders and the Chinese flag officers were not able to control a group of lieutenants on Hainan Island, and that they could spark one of the world's most deadly confrontations, and that the Chinese leaders could do nothing about it. So clearly, you know, this is a very, very bad story either way, but I think certainly that this is directed from Beijing.
The Wall Street Journal reports today that the U.S. military is really trying to cast this in a very different light. Let me just give you a quote from a so-called senior U.S. official, Gordon, and that is, quote, "The Chinese are trying to be more active in establishing good quality military-to-military relations. There's just something different and unique about what's going on in the South China Sea," unquote. It really seems to me as though this is a case of whistling past the graveyard, Gordon. Not the only one by any means, but it reflects this notion that if we just beaver away at trying to show them more about our military capabilities, that they will understand us better and be less threatened by us and be more accommodating and be good military-to-military partners. You have expressed profound skepticism of this line of thinking in the past. Have recent events in any way caused you to think differently?
Recent events clearly have caused us to think that China is indeed a problem. You know, we invited China to RIMPAC 2014, which is the largest naval exercise in the world, and China participated in that. But they also sent an uninvited spy ship to do reconnaissance on the exercises. This is the first time that a country has done that. So what we see are a pattern of very troubling incidents. And if you just go back the last 6 or 7 months, we have not only the problems at RIMPAC, we have not only the problems on August 19th in the air with our P-8, but we also have the Cowpens incident in the South China Sea, where a Chinese vessel crossed the bow of the Cowpens at perhaps something like 75 meters. So clearly there is a pattern here. We need to recognize it. And the problem is that officials in Washington, as in other capitals, don't recognize that the Chinese can have a dual-pronged strategy. One of them is to be nice and the other to be incredibly hostile. And so we have to take that into account.
Gordon, you have written recently and in the past, of course, about Xi Jinping's aspiration, which he is making a major leitmotif of his efforts to consolidate power. This, of course, being the Chinese president, namely the Chinese dream. How do you characterize that dream, and how does it relate to the kind of behavior that you've just been describing?
Well, the Chinese describe the dream as the rejuvenation of the Chinese state. And what this really talks about is a strong country, but also a strong state and a weak populace. So clearly this is an authoritarian dream, something very dangerous. We've seen this before, especially in the 20th century, where you have authoritarian, totalitarian leaders talk about the rejuvenation of their countries. And part of this, of course, is China exercising dominion over its peripheral seas, the South China Sea, East China Sea, Indian Ocean, and also grabbing territory from its neighbors. And the process, of course, what they're doing is they are completely undercutting the notion of freedom of navigation, which the United States has defended for more than two centuries. So the China dream is something which is completely inconsistent with a peaceful and stable world order.
Yeah, it sure seems like a Chinese nightmare for its neighbors and for American interests in that part of the world. And I think, again, to be construing it otherwise and making excuses for the Chinese is evidence of a serious rot in our national security thinking on this subject, Gordon. And we always appreciate your clarity on these matters because it is obviously needed. Gordon Chang, let me turn to one other topic that you've been addressing lately because it's of very considerable interest. A key element of China's behavior is evidently a function of its concern about its own energy security, its increasing assertiveness on the world's oceans, notably, and efforts to seize underwater resources from places like, well, Vietnam and the Philippines. It has a lot, it appears, to do with the desire to gain access to its own oil resources. And yet you've chronicled a serious setback, it would appear, in terms of its exploitation of what are unmistakably its resources on its own soil, namely shale gas. Talk a little bit about what's going on there and what the strategic implications of it might be.
For the second time, Chinese officials have reduced their target production of shale gas for the 2020 year. Now it's basically one-third of what it started out to be. This is important because China was placed a lot of emphasis on shale. They have the world's largest shale reserves, almost twice America's, but they clearly are having trouble exploiting it. And I think it's because they have a top-down system. The reason why we have an energy boom in the United States is not because of the energy majors, the Exxon Mobils of the world. It's because of wildcatters, independents, who figured out how to make fracking and horizontal drilling to be economically feasible. In China, they're going about the exploitation of shale gas through their state oil companies, of course. And the state oil companies don't have the economic incentive to make shale feasible. Just like it's in the United States, it doesn't really make that much sense for the majors, but it does make sense for the independents. And that shows the genius of the American economic system and the real problems in China's.
Gordon, let me turn finally to another topic. You, of course, are the author of a book about how North Korea is taking on the world. Talk, if you would, quickly about evidence that the North Koreans are working to build a long-range missile capable of delivering nuclear weapons to the United States.
North Korea's dreams for a long-range missile go back decades and decades. They're apparently building a new launch site which will be capable of handling a missile with a much longer range. This we should expect because then Defense Secretary Gates said in 2011 that the North Koreans in about 5 years would be able to land something in the continental United States. They can already do that, but really without very much precision. Basically, what they're doing is making step-by-step progress towards that goal. And of course, at the same time, they're developing nuclear warheads. So this is going to be an existential issue for the United States because they will be able to land a warhead any place in the U.S. within 2 or 3 years, maybe 3 or 4. But, you know, we're talking about something which they are going to be able to do because they're making reliable progress and they're getting help from Iran.
And they're providing help to Iran at the same time, which raises the question of the imminence of a threat from that quarter as well. These are the sorts of things that we need to make sure are in front of our policymakers. We appreciate very much your sharing them with us, and we look forward to further visiting with you in the near future on these and other issues. Keep up the great work in the meantime, my friend. Good to have you with us. Next up, Ralph Peters will join us. We'll talk with him about ISIS, the Islamic State, and what we better be doing about it. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Specialist or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there. America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, I'm very pleased to say, joined by a friend and much admired colleague, Ralph Peters, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Army, retired, now a Fox News strategic analyst. You can find his writings in all the right places, including at the New York Post. He is the author most recently of Hell or Richmond, shortly to come out in paperback. It's always good to have him with us. Welcome back, Colonel. Glad to have you.
Hey, always great to speak with you, Frank.
You have taken the administration, I think it's fair to say, to task for not having brought to bear the kind of power against this group that goes by varying names, the Islamic State, I think is its current favorite, the Caliphate, also known as the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or the Sham and ISIL and so on. Your concern, I gather, is not so much with their rhetoric, which is to say this is a very dangerous group, but that they're not actually hammering this outfit. Talk a little bit about why that disconnect matters so much.
Well, it matters so much because in foreign policy, you have to deal with reality, especially where wild, violent, apocalyptic movements are involved. And the reluctance, and to be fair, the Bush administration would refuse to recognize the full dimensions of the Islamist threat as well. But the Obama administration takes a cake because obviously you had the retreat from Iraq. And I'm sick and tired of people politicizing this. Okay, as my view, the Bush administration, in getting rid of Saddam Hussein, did a great thing inexcusably badly. The Bushies screwed up. Got it. But that doesn't excuse Obama screwing up colossally by retreating as fast as he could from Iraq after, despite all the Bush administration's errors, our troops had finally pulled it out. There was a convalescent Iraq that had at least a slight chance of lasting a few more decades. In our troops, our presence, even a small presence, was a fig leaf all the parties needed to continue grudgingly getting along.
Behaving themselves. We're visiting with Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters, United States Army retired, now a Fox News strategic analyst and best-selling author and pundit par excellence. You were describing the failure of the Obama administration to help Iraq get through this difficult transition. Where has that failure left us with respect specifically to this so-called Islamic State, but more broadly, Ralph Peters, with respect to this really strategically important country of Iraq?
Well, it has left us on the sidelines. Now, I do not believe that that military forces are the answer to every one of the globe's problems. But there are times when you have no option except the military. And the Obama administration's not just reluctance, but refusal to take action in Syria early on when it could have made a difference, later against ISIS, now just Islamic State, has really cost us badly because in the strategic vacuum left behind by Obama, malevolent actors, malignant actors, love a strategic vacuum. And so inaction was not the answer. And what we have seen with Islamic State and their self-declared caliphate, Frank, and I think you and I are on the same page about this, is it's part of a horrific plague, a plague of distorted belief that afflicts much of the Muslim world, the Middle East, North Africa, parts of the Sahel, the first tier of sub-Saharan Africa. So although at present Islamic State is by far the greatest threat because it's of this emerging terror state in the heart of the Middle East, far more important strategically than Afghanistan could ever be. But there are also related movements who aren't quite as powerful right now but have the same general beliefs. And it's a reflection of the spiritual, moral, physical decay of much of Islamic civilization. And I'm sorry, but it's true. And if we are unwilling to face how sick the civilization of the Middle East and North Africa has become, we can't begin to cope with a problem the dimensions of which we're unwilling to recognize. I got to say that for years I really hoped that the Muslim population of the Middle East could get it together. There were some hopeful signs, But ultimately, these regressive, violent, apocalyptic movements have proved to have stronger appeal to the youth than civilization has.
Yeah. Well, and part of that, we'll be talking more with Eric Edelman shortly about this. Part of that, it seems, is very clearly that these jihadists, these Sharia-adherent elements are being bankrolled by nation states like Qatar, notably, and Turkey, and at least some of them by Saudi Arabia.
And that
enables a lot of this. But in the case of the Islamic State, they seem also to have figured out that there are ways of self-funding, whether it's by robbing banks or by selling oil or by selling electricity or taxing people or whatever. And I guess what I'm interested in with you, Ralph, is we're witnessing at the moment the Obama administration using force, and we're told that bombing missions are being run to neutralize a Humvee.
Yeah.
And an mechanized artillery piece and one other armored vehicle. This does not seem to be the sort of hammering you have in mind, I take it.
Oh, no, certainly not. And the president himself, to my surprise, used the word cancer to describe this threat. Well, that's a very good metaphor. The problem is the president for years now has ignored the cancer, hoping it would just get better on its own, and malignant cancers do not get better on their own. Well, now he's trying to shave off little bits of the tumor with these tactical airstrikes, which are helping. They're helping the Kurds. There's no question about it. But, you know, he just won't take on the whole tumor, the dimensions of the disease, so it continues to grow and spread. The face is problem. Now, as to your comments about the funding, yeah, we have looked away while individual Saudis, the government of Qatar, various other Gulf Arabs and the individuals and organizations of the United Arab Emirates have funded these
Turkey.
Extremist movements.
Yeah,
yeah, and Turkey, too,
in a big way.
Appears to have. But, when something interesting happened just within the last 36 hours, and that's that one of the extremist groups, not as extreme as Islamic State, but active in Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Nusra Front, released an American journalist they'd held captive for 2 years. You know what they were? They're scared, you know, they've got it. You know, they see these air attacks, and what they were saying with that release was, "We're not Islamic State. Don't bomb us." And I think the Qataris were behind it because the Qataris have been big funders of Jabhat al-Nusra. They were, you know, they appear to have funded Islamic State early on. I think the Qataris now recognize that we're mad. They can't necessarily save Islamic State, so they're going to try to save Jabhat al-Nusra. So the level of complication, duplicity, treachery in this region, while we pretend these people are our allies, is just stunning to me.
Yeah,
I mean, how willfully naive can you be?
Yeah. Well, and Ralph, this is really the last point I guess we've got time for today, but we'll visit more with you, I hope, about it in the near future. I'm really concerned that if we don't focus on this larger Sharia enterprise, which you've described very nicely in its various component parts, we're going to wind up once again chasing off into a rabbit hole, even if we do what clearly I think is in order to counter this metastasizing cancer of the Islamic State,
right,
at the risk of allowing an awful lot of this other stuff to go on with other states, with other nations, with other populations. Ralph Peters, I have to leave it at that, I'm afraid, just because we are hard out of time. But I do hope we'll have a chance to visit about this again in the future. In the meantime, thank you for all of the clarity that you bring to these matters in places like Fox News and the New York Post. Keep it up, and do, in the very near future, come back to us, if you will. Next up, we will speak to former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Eric Edelman. We'll talk about Turkey, Russia, and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The menacing ruthlessness of the jihadist group that calls itself the Islamic State is prompting some to say the United States should declare war on these increasingly powerful terrorists. But that would be like declaring war on Hitler's SS stormtroopers instead of Nazism, or the Soviet KGB instead of communism. The Islamic State is just a manifestation of the underlying totalitarian ideology that impels it, Sharia. The reality is that Sharia's adherents, whether they operate under the banners of, for example, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, or the Islamic State, have long been at war with us. So, let's do what we should have done years ago. Declare war on Sharia and wage it as though our lives and posterity depend upon our victory. For, indeed, they do. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, I'm very pleased to say, with the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the United States Defense Department under George W. Bush, a man who served in a number of different capacities, our government, including as a career minister in the U.S. Foreign Service, with, to his credit, among other posts, the role of ambassador to Finland and to Turkey, which is very much on our mind at the moment. His name is Eric Edelman. Eric, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Frank. Good to be with you.
In the previous segment, I was talking with Colonel Ralph Peters about this group, the Islamic State, and the support that they, among other jihadist elements, have been receiving, notably but not exclusively in Syria, from the country to which you were once posted as our ambassador, namely Turkey. What is the nature of the relationship of the Turks to these characters, and what does it say about Turkey's reliability as a NATO partner? Eric?
Well, unfortunately, I think it doesn't reflect terribly well on Turkey as a NATO partner. First, the Turks, for some period of time, about 10 years ago, took the Assad regime under their wing when it was being isolated by most of the rest of the international community after the assassination of Rafiq Hariri back in 2005.
Which they were credited for having done.
Which was a Syrian hand was clearly both directly and through Hezbollah a part of. But after the rebellion broke out against the Assad regime in 2011, the Turkish government first tried to use what they believed was the accrued influence they had with Assad from having courted him for so long to try and change his direction. And when that failed, they turned on him with a vengeance But what they did was adopt a very, very Sunni-centric sectarian foreign policy, which led them to both turn a blind eye to what was going on across the Turkish-Syrian border in Idlib province, where a lot of the rebellion was brewing, but also supporting some of the Islamist elements. I think they were most closely associated with Jabhat al-Nusra, which remains an al-Qaeda affiliate. But the net result was that a lot of the so-called ISIL or ISIS folks passed through Turkey into Syria, got arms and equipment and funding through Turkey. Some of it already blew back several years ago with the bombing that took place in Rahanle in southeastern Turkey. Now this has really bitten the Turks. The Turks have found that the ISIL folks are not only not reliable, they're very dangerous to Turkey. They're not a reliable instrument of Turkish policy. They're holding Turkish diplomats hostage in Mosul. The policy's become very unpopular inside Turkey. And you now see signs that the Turkish government recognizes that and has begun to crack down on this. But it's a little bit like slamming the barn door after the horse is gone. There have been interviews with ISIL figures who, as recently as a few months ago, were receiving medical treatment in Turkey, who are now saying, well, we can't get back to Turkey for medical treatment, but we don't need Turkey anymore because we've now seized so much weaponry and so much money that, you know, we're a force unto ourselves.
But again, what is so troubling about this is even if the Turks were finally to cut off this Islamic State operation, they're still very clearly involved with the al-Nusra Front, for example, in Syria, which is an al-Qaeda operation, and other Islamist enterprises, including, hardly least, the Muslim Brotherhood.
And, you know, not only is that the case, Frank, but the main architect of this policy, Ahmet Davutoğlu, the foreign minister, is now being promoted to prime minister and chairman of the AK party in Turkey, the governing party under now President Erdogan. So not only are people not being held accountable for this policy disaster, but they're actually being promoted for it.
Yeah. Well, this raises the question, and Eric Edelman is again our guest. He is currently a distinguished fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Analysis and a visiting scholar at the Johns Hopkins University. Eric, you served in Turkey, of course, as our ambassador, and I just would again ask you, in light of the apparent consolidation of power by Prime Minister, now President Erdogan, and this architect of his disastrous foreign policy, Davutoğlu, are we going to see Turkey become even less of a nation that we can safely consider an ally, let alone a reliable part of NATO?
Well, there was a RAND study several years ago, Frank, of Turkey, which said it was going to be an increasingly unreliable NATO ally in the future. And I think, unfortunately, that judgment's been borne out. And part of the problem is NATO is an alliance of democracies. And Turkey, although it certainly has the trappings of democracy, you just had a free election for president, but it was hardly, you know, a fair election. You know, Erdogan had a just enormous, overwhelming advantage on television and other media. The other candidates barely could have their voices heard. Turkey is, you know, turning at least right now into a, quote, managed democracy, kind of on the Putin model.
Yeah, on the Putin model, indeed.
And, you know, that increasingly that trend towards one-man rule, towards authoritarianism, towards systematic elimination of the other elements of pluralism in Turkey, a free press, independent judiciary, you know, a strong military, those things are all being destroyed or eliminated. I think, you know, over time, it's really going to be a big, big problem for the management of the alliance.
Well, I certainly do, too. But let me turn quickly to something else that you've been involved in, which is very important, Eric, and that is against the backdrop of this drama, the rising tide of these global jihadists, as I say, animated by Sharia. What's happening to our friends in Israel at the hands of one of those groups, Hamas, the activities of Putin, to whom you alluded a moment ago, in the Ukraine and elsewhere in the so-called near abroad, the Chinese, as we talked about with Gordon Chang at the top of the show, becoming more aggressive. You have recently participated in the latest iteration of something called the National Defense Panel, to provide kind of a second opinion on what we're doing with respect to the adequacy of our military preparedness for such a dangerous world.
The National Defense Panel that was chartered by Congress to provide a second opinion on the Quadrennial Defense Review of the Department of Defense that was issued in February of this year actually began its work last summer. And it was a bipartisan panel co-chaired by former Secretary of Defense under Bill Clinton, Secretary Perry, and General John Abizaid, former commander of Central Command. And it was, I think, there was not very much difference among the members of the panel on the main strategic issues, which is to say that the country faces accumulating strategic risk from an increasingly difficult international security environment and a more complex security environment than we've probably faced in any of our lifetimes, with a rising China, with the continued threat of violent extremist jihadism that you and I have just been talking about this morning, the emergence of new nuclear powers like North Korea and perhaps soon Iran. This is just going to become a very, very difficult environment for us to operate in. And against that background, the more than $1 trillion defense cut over the 10-year future defense plan that the administration has been both executing and talking about since it came into office in 2009 has really become a disaster for the Department of Defense. And so the panel called...
And for the country, more to the point.
For the nation, of course. And so the panel called for... And a disaster for the nation's ability to defend itself. Which is, the primary responsibility of the Congress under the Constitution. And so we called for essentially an elimination of the Budget Control Act of 2011 caps on defense spending, elimination of sequestration, a return to the budget level that was put forward by Secretary Gates for the fiscal year 12 budget, which was really the last time the department was allowed to do a real needs-based assessment of defense spending, as opposed to just taking numbers randomly assigned to it by either OMB or the Congress.
And trying to see what kind of capabilities you could buy with it. Eric Edelman, this is a subject for a much longer conversation, which I hope you might indulge me in at some point in the near future, because I think both your characterization of the threat environment we're in and the degree to which this hollowing out of our military is exacerbating it by inviting aggressiveness on the part of the country's many enemies is the sort of thing that we really need help thinking our way through and, as you say, taking some very important corrective actions. Eric Edelman, thank you very much for the work you're doing at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Analysis and in so many other places. Keep it up. We'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, former Ambassador Roger Noriega joins us. We'll talk with him about the latest on the border crisis and how the Obama administration seems...
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at DailyCaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at DailyCaller.com.
It could be your father, your sister, your neighbor, or your best friend. Or it could be someone like this soldier who writes, quote, "This is a great thing you are doing here. Keep up the good work." AnySoldier.com has become synonymous with goodwill and great stuff. The troops really appreciate the effort. Take care and thanks again, end quote. Log on to www.anysoldier.com and find out what you can do to help our deployed men and women in the armed forces.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, I'm very pleased to say, joined by one of the people that we turn to for his expertise on yet another very important part of the world and part of the war for the free world, namely Roger Noriega and Latin America. Roger comes to this distinction by virtue of his very considerable service to our country in a number of capacities, including as the Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs and as the U.S. Permanent Representative to the Organization of American States. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you for the opportunity, Frank.
I'd like to start with something that you wrote for the McClatchy Tribune Syndicate about the border crisis. Roger Noriega, talk a little bit about how this is developing as kind of an exercise in political operations rather than, well, national security?
Well, it's very clear, Frank, that the president's loose talk about amnesty and, worse yet, the decisions he's made unilaterally using so-called executive authorities to extend the essential amnesty to young people living in the United States illegally has sent a message to Central American coyotes, these people smugglers, that if they could get somebody to the border, they could essentially stay. And you see some great reporting, for example, in the Washington Examiner, about how these coyotes changed their business model to essentially market this to people in Central America. So the president bears direct responsibility for what's happened on our border. And we can deal with these issues if we deal you know, in an effective way as a government and not just the president working at cross purposes with the Congress. And the message I'm sending essentially is the president should not do further unilateral measures that will poison the well for serious cooperation, getting the resources we need from Congress to deal with the security on our border and eventually reform an immigration system that obviously isn't working. The president plays political games with this. He will make matters even worse than his words already have.
Yeah. And as you note in this article, Roger, even the Honduran president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, has noted the pull factor that is enticing people to emigrate from his country illegally to ours. He also talks about their reasons, the push factor, as he puts it, for them leaving Honduras for fear of, you know, their lives and so on. But what you've just described, it seems, in terms of the possibility of a further unilateral action, presumably knowing this president to be taken on the eve of the Labor Day weekend, to further intensify that pull factor by leniency, or however you want to describe it, effectively amnesty, would greatly exacerbate the present problem.
Absolutely. And we're going to all wish that maybe he was back on the golf course before this is all over. But this is hardly a humanitarian measure, because essentially what it does is create a magnet where hundreds of thousands potentially of poor Central Americans throwing themselves into the Mexican desert to risk the 1,000-mile trek up to the U.S. border.
At the mercy of these coyotes, yeah.
Absolutely, and they pay $5,000 to $7,000 for this so-called service. How many of them are abused? How many of them die on the way? So I think the president needs to be extraordinarily careful and learn here in his sixth or seventh year of his presidency that words matter. And an irresponsible action it could have very grave consequences, not only for our security, but for the well-being of the people that he's supposedly trying to help.
Yeah, ostensibly. Roger, let me turn to another part of your portfolio in Latin America, and that is, of course, Venezuela. The Venezuelan government has gotten itself into such desperate straits economically that it is selling off one of its prized possessions, among other things, for its influence operations in the United States, namely the oil company known as Citgo. Talk a little bit about both what is impelling it to take that step and how this is playing into the effort to have U.S. sanctions imposed upon the Venezuelan regime for what it is doing to its own people politically as well as economically.
Well, I've likened the Venezuelan regime to sort of a mafia. And this is kind of a mafia taking over a piece of pizza parlor and then busting it out for the insurance money and burning it down or selling it off piece by piece. And that's essentially what they're doing with this Venezuelan economy, in this case, the oil industry. Citgo is the crown jewel because it was this link to the retail sales for that heavy Venezuelan crude network of refineries, all of that. So this is really lifeblood of the Venezuelan petroleum industry, and for them to be selling this off shows a level of desperation. I would also say caveat emptor, because I note that in the last couple of years, when the Chinese were making loans to Venezuela at one time, our sources say that they wanted a piece of Citgo. The Chinese did as a security on one of these loans. So if I were buying in the market to buy an oil company for $10 or $11 or $12 billion, I would be very careful about who I might be taking on as a partner there.
Yeah, as usual, these are the kind of company that you probably don't want to be keeping either way, Venezuelan or Chinese. And I'm hearing that Senator Mary Landrieu, who is in the midst of a tough reelection race, Roger, is now stymieing efforts to get these sorts of sanctions adopted, for which there is seemingly very broad bipartisan support. But she's holding out on the grounds that somehow this might jeopardize the jobs of some employees of Citgo in her state. Talk a little bit, if you would, about the both, well, the seemliness of that kind of self-interest, I guess, is the generous way to put it, but also the accuracy of her efforts.
Well, I'm rather surprised by the news that she'd be holding this up, because this bipartisan measure, support of her party's own chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, principal sponsor of the legislation, Bob Menendez of New Jersey, it targets human rights violators. So if representatives of Citgo are telling Mary Landrieu that human rights violators are members of their team, I think that is rather remarkable. And I think she needs to be educated about the implications of the legislation and the decision that she's taking to block the U.S. taking effective measures, the Congress speaking out in a bipartisan way in defense of human rights, and on the side of our friends, really, who want to bring about change in Venezuela. I think after they return to town after this August break, I hope that that members have a chance to educate one another on the implications of that legislation and move forward with it swiftly, because I think the message is really needed that the United States, at least the Congress, is paying some attention to those who are violating human rights on behalf of a criminal regime.
Yeah, and at a considerable risk to our security interests as well. Roger, we only have about a minute. Very quickly, again, our guest is Roger Noriega, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs and now visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Quickly, what has happened in the past few days in Brazil to upend the election there that is now in the offing?
Well, in the last year, Rousseff's approval ratings for her policies have plummeted. In the last month, the race is scrambled by the death of a much more popular Socialist Party candidate. What remains to be seen is whether that Socialist Party candidate or a pro-business candidate move on to the second round that will challenge Rousseff on October 25th. But the future of Brazil is really at stake in these elections, and you might actually see a case where free market principles are vindicated as a way of jumpstarting one of the most important economies in South America.
We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you. Roger Noriega, thank you for joining us. Thank you for the work you do, among other places, at Inter-American Security Watch and Vision Americas. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.